Matthew 9, and a number of other places too, but we'll start in Matthew 9. This is our fourth week, fourth of 12 weeks, where we're exploring the gospel according to Matthew this summer. Matthew's a long book. It's 28 chapters. It's over 1,100 verses. If we were trying to study it verse by verse, word by word, we'd be studying it for years. And that's fine. Some churches do that. That's not what we're doing over the summer. What we're doing these 12 weeks is we're trying to hit some of the passages and parts of Matthew that are really unique to Matthew, that really smack of the flavor of Matthew, so that hopefully you can get a kind of a broad sense of what Matthew tastes like or feels like. So a lot of what we're, most of what we're hitting, honestly, during the season is stuff that's only found in the gospel according to Matthew. You would not have this in the Bible if Matthew disappeared. So that's today I want to look at just a bit of a personal story for Matthew. It's in Matthew chapter 9. It's the moment when Jesus changed Matthew's life. It's a story that's actually is preserved for us in Mark and Luke as well, but there's something small in this story, the way that Matthew tells it, that's utterly unique. It's utterly unique to Matthew. It would be gone if Matthew disappeared. So, first slide, slide number one. Matthew chapter 9, verse 9. As Jesus went on from there, he's in his hometown, by the way. You find that out in verse 1. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. Let's pause right here for a moment. If we're at all familiar with the life of Jesus, we remember, of course, that Jesus is a first century Jewish peasant, and he's proclaiming something. And he's enacting something. What's he doing? He's proclaiming the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven is what it's called in Matthew. That's what the Jewish people had been hoping for and longing for and looking for centuries. We want things to be as God wants them to be. We want God's rule and reign to come to the world. And Jesus is announcing it. That's the life of Jesus. He's proclaiming that things are finally becoming as God wants them to be. And he's doing more than just proclaiming them. He's putting his money where his mouth is because he's actually practicing it. He's not just proclaiming the kingdom. He's practicing the kingdom. He's performing the kingdom for people. The life of Jesus, everything he does, everywhere he goes, whatever he's doing, the life of heaven is arriving in and through Jesus. He's healing. He's restoring sight to people. He's feeding. He's forgiving. All of that, every bit of that, is what it looks like when the life of heaven starts coming to earth. That's what it looks like. When God's in charge, people are healed. Sight's restored. People have enough food to eat. People find themselves forgiven. But then Jesus does something really strange here in this passage. This is Matthew 9. It's like he does something, we don't say it like this, but it's unquestionably inappropriate. It's really inappropriate is what Jesus is doing. He is hanging out with not just hanging out, he is in solidarity with, he's eating with. This is a picture of like the deepest kind of friendship and solidarity in this kind of culture in the ancient Near East. He's got solidarity and friendship with the entirely wrong kinds of people. If we were to be honest, with the worst kind of people. Tax collectors are the worst. Not just the person bugging you about unpaid taxes here on the phone, but like back in Jesus' day, they're genuinely awful people, traitors and thieves. They are. traitors. I mean, seriously, traitors and thieves. Traitors because they've switched to jerseys. They've taken off the jersey and they've put on the wrong jersey. They've joined up with the enemy, with the people who are occupying the city, the land. They've joined up with Rome. These are the people who have burned the flag. These are the people who have betrayed their blood. These are the people who have left the faith. They're not good people. Imagine if we heard on the news, if you even heard about, like, from friends or something, that someone from Westminster or Arvada, something like Brighton, wherever, had begun fundraising, had begun collecting money to support ISIS or Al-Qaeda. You're like, wait a minute. Most Americans would say, have you lost your mind? You know what you are supporting. I'm probably not going to go have lunch with you, mainly because I think that the NSA has probably got your house bugged and is watching you through your cameras or something, you know, something like that. But, like, they are the enemy. You are fine. There is nothing good about you. That's similar to the way that people would have felt about tax collectors. Have you lost your mind, Matthew? He's called Levi, is another name. It's like C.S. Lewis was called Jack. I don't know where we get that from, but he was called Jack. Matthew's called Levi in Mark and Luke. But Matthew, have you lost your mind? Do you know who you are supporting? You are working for the enemy. You are collecting money. The money that you collect goes to support that hateful army. You are paying the soldiers on our streets and our cities and in our land. You are helping stop the kingdom of God from coming. There's nothing good about what you're doing. And evidently, because of your priorities, there is nothing good about you. So tax collectors are already popular because they're traitors, but then you could add thievery to their list of virtues as well as to their resume, because it's not like tax collectors. Tax collectors, it's not like they went and filled out a W-4 and an I-9 or something and gave it to, and then they regularly get a regular paycheck or something from the Roman bank. That's not how tax collectors got paid. No, tax collectors basically paid themselves. That's how tax collectors got paid. Let's say, for example, that you owed Rome $100 each month in taxes. What Matthew would do is he'd probably collect $110 from you. Well, 100 for Rome, and then 10 for the middleman. 10 to help the guy who's facilitating this nice transaction. We know that you want to be supporting Rome and all the soldiers that are keeping you and your people under oppression. So you need that middleman, so I'll take 10 for myself. That's how a tax collector got paid. That's how he got paid. They basically paid themselves from what they collected from everyone else. They skimmed a little off the top. Or let's be honest, they skimmed a lot off the top if they could make. That's what people do, don't they? You know, if you can, why not collect $120 or $130 if you could? You don't want to pay? You don't want to pay? You don't want to support Rome? Well, if you don't want to come by Matthew's tax booth, Matthew still got to collect the money somehow. Rome has got to be paid one way or another. Otherwise, Matthew loses his job or loses maybe more than that. And Rome would just find another tax collector who would get them their money. And so Matthew, if you don't want to come by his tax booth, Matthew comes to you. Matthew comes to your place of residence, your place of business. He makes you an offer you can't refuse, is what a tax collector has to do. He gets the money. One way or another. Rome and its thousands and thousands of soldiers have got to be paid. The money's got to keep flowing. And Matthew's just the local middleman who's making it happen and getting a cut. Tax collectors, we might think of them as like an IRS agent, wonderful, and a loan shark, even better, and the Repo Man, all rolled up into one nice, wonderful package. That's about what a tax collector is. You would become a tax collector so that you got to get a little bit of money, so that you could get a little bit of money, that you would get a cut. It would be a way of getting some sort of financial security in a tumultuous world. It would be a way of getting some money. It would be a good way of getting hated by people, basically. People in the first century, they argued about a lot of things. I know you can't imagine a world where people argue about things, but they argued about a lot of things. There was a diverse opinions in the first century. They argued conservative and liberal in politics. They argued Hillel and Shammai in Bible study. They argued Broncos and Raiders in sports, but they could all agree on one thing. We can all agree that those people are terrible people. Those people, traitors and thieves they are. They're the worst kind of people. Those people over there are genuinely awful. Those people, we can agree, should not be the people that Jesus is hanging out with. He's in solidarity with. He is in friendship with. These are the people. This is a person that Jesus invites to follow him. Verse 9. Jesus sees Matthew at his tax booth, and he doesn't see a label. He sees a life. He doesn't see a label. He doesn't see traitor or thief. He doesn't see a problem. He sees a person. He sees a person who's trying to figure out what it means to make his way in the world, to live in the world. Like, I got to find some financial security. I got to find, it's a dangerous, cutthroat world we live in. I got to figure this out. He just sees a person who, he sees a person who's hurting other people, to be sure, but he sees a person who's hurting himself and a person needing guidance, healing, forgiveness, a person who needs mercy. A person who just needs mercy. And that's what Jesus gives him. He gives him mercy. I'm not going to denigrate you. I'm not going to label you. I'm not going to, like everyone. No, just come. You can come too. You too. Come. Follow me. And so Matthew does, verse 9. He gets up and follows. He leaves the note. Like, he leaves his tax collector's booth, presumably unattended. This is a big deal. He's like the other disciples who had left their fishing nets, their livelihoods. This is the way that I make money in the world. Matthew just leaves it, leaves his tax booth. And then Jesus goes and he has dinner at his house. And this is where it gets wildly inappropriate. Because Matthew's left his old life behind. Okay, he's changed his life, had some sort of religious experience, he's got some sort of convert, whatever, like 5 minutes ago. Okay, but he hasn't quite cleaned up all of his life yet. But who are all of Matthew's friends? Well, Matthew's got a pretty small network of people that he can hang out with and that like him, actually. And those are also genuinely awful people. Those are the people that everybody hates. And here's the thing. Those people had not repented yet. They have not changed their lives yet. And who knows what Jesus is doing, eating or drinking, whatever, with those people over there. My goodness. These people are the problem. These people are, if someone's fundraising for ISIS or Al-Qaeda, you're the problem. These people are the problem. Jesus, are you so naive? You're so smart, but are you so dumb? These people, you're announcing the kingdom of heaven, but these people are working for an entirely different kingdom. These people are working for the kingdom called Rome. For an entirely different, it is counter to everything that you stand for. I don't mean to be blunt, but are you foolish? Are you foolish, Jesus? Are you completely unaware of your actions, of what you are doing? Don't you know that you are defiling yourself by being with these people? That's what the law says. You are getting dirty. Like, stain, dirtiness is getting on you from them. You're doing some great stuff, Jesus, but these people are getting you a little dirty. You're ruining your witness. Good grief. What will people say about you? According to almost every religious standard of the day, what you're doing is worse than unhelpful, Jesus. It is worse than unhelpful. Worse than unwise, Jesus. It is unholy. It is unholy. Next slide. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Of course they asked that. These are the wrong kinds of people. These are the people they're part of the problem. On hearing this, verse 12, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." I said that this story is also included in Mark and Luke. They both include that part about the healthy don't need a doctor. Jesus has come to call sinners, not those who think that they already have their act together. But Matthew is the only gospel writer to include that bit in the middle, right there in that bottom paragraph, that bit where Jesus quotes from the Bible. Jesus, the spunk of Jesus, the sass of Jesus. Jesus tells the religious experts, the religious geniuses, "You should really go back and learn what the Bible is about." That's what he says to them. "You go back and actually learn what God says in the Bible." Centuries ago as a people, when we fell under the judgment of God as a people, what did God tell us? He told us what was important, what was most central, what we'd been missing the boat on. It's not that we didn't have all our religious stuff right. It's not that we weren't giving the right sacrifices. It's that we weren't acting in love towards one another. It's that we weren't acting in love towards one another. We weren't being merciful to each other. God said through the prophet Hosea, "Don't you remember this, guys? I desire mercy, not sacrifice." And what you're seeing from me right now, in this moment, that it's wildly inappropriate. What you're seeing is mercy on full display. That's what you're seeing. To borrow a phrase from G.K. Chesterton, Jesus was walking around the world like the pardon of God. That's what Jesus was doing. He was walking the world as the pardon of God. Matthew is the only gospel writer to record this quotation from the prophet Hosea. I'm suspicious that this is my guess. I think he's the only one to record this because it was really important to him. Like, it was this moment where he's like, "Oh, yes, that's what the Bible's about. Yes, that's where salvation meets me." Oh, he'd experienced Jesus as the pardon of God, the mercy of God in Jesus saying, "Come, follow me." It had struck him to the core, and he finally had a place in the Bible where he's like, "That's it. That's where it is. That's what God has always wanted in the world. Not more religion. Not more sacrifice. Not more vestments. Not more trappings. Not more religious ceremony and incense and that sort of stuff. He wants mercy. Desire mercy. Kindness, compassion. Matthew could never forget. That's why he includes it. He could never forget when Jesus quoted Hosea, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice." Those words just struck him. Those words changed the way that he understood not only God and the scriptures, but life and everything, the way that he walks in the world. And he wants to make sure that anybody who reads his account of Jesus, he wants to make sure that we hear those words too. So much so that he included them right here. So much so that he actually repeats them in Matthew 12. Next slide. In Matthew 12, Jesus' disciples are doing something that the religious experts don't like. They're picking grain on the Sabbath. Don't worry about it. And so the religious experts approach Jesus and they say, "Hey, Jesus, why are they doing that? You realize that they're violating the religious rules, don't you?" And Jesus replies, "If you had known what these words mean, I desire mercy, not sacrifice." In case we missed it in Matthew 9, he's repeating it right here in Matthew 12. Matthew's the only one this is central to Matthew. He's the only one doing this. "I desire mercy, not sacrifice," verse 7 of chapter 12. "You would not have condemned the innocent." He includes these words from Hosea again. He's the only gospel writer to do so. They're pretty important to him. Back in just flashback, just a little bit of context about what Hosea was saying. Back in Hosea's day, so this is 700 years before Jesus. In Hosea's day, the people of God had fallen under God's judgment. Not because they told like a little white lie or because they had like said a naughty word when they stubbed their toe or something like that. No. It's actually, next slide, it's actually because the people of God had become corrupt to the core. They had actually become a force for evil in the world. This is a little bit of context for Hosea. Hosea says, "Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying, and murder, stealing, and adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed." No faithfulness, no love. Cursing each other is what's implied here. Lying, murder, stealing, adultery, bloodshed after bloodshed is what was happening in Hosea's day. And so the Lord brought judgment against them as a nation, as a people. They would be conquered. They would be torn to bits. They would be disassembled as a nation. And that's what happened. An empire called Assyria conquered them, tore them apart. But then eventually, next slide, slide 5, eventually Hosea continues, and he's speaking for the people as a whole right here, and he says, "Come, Hosea 6, verse 1, come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will restore us, that we may live in his presence. Let us acknowledge the Lord. Let us press on to acknowledge him. As surely as the sun rises, he will appear. He will come to us like the winter rains, like the spring rains that water the earth." Interesting side note here that I just wanted to point out. According to Hosea, the doctor who would come and heal them would be God himself. Interestingly enough, the doctor who would come and heal them would. And so when Jesus quotes from the prophet Hosea and calls himself a doctor, there's something pretty big loaded in there. A side note. Next slide, slide 6. And then finally, the doctor, the healer, comes to the people. He arrives and he says, "I desire mercy, not sacrifice and acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. God comes as a doctor to this people who have been blood shedding blood after shedding blood, and he tells them, it's not your sacrifices I want, it's not your religion that I want, I want chesed from you. I want loyal love from you. That's what I want. I don't want lying anymore. I want love. I don't want bloodshed. I want brotherhood. I don't want murder. I want mercy. And that's what Matthew's quoting right here. He's invoking all of this. He's bringing it right here in front of them because he's hanging out with the wrong people. He's bringing all of this right here and dropping it before them and saying, this is what God wants. God doesn't want more religion. He wants eleos, is how it gets translated into the Greek. I want kindness, compassion, mercy. Back in Hosea's day, the people of God knew that they were under God's judgment. They knew that God himself had like dismantled them. He'd torn them apart. But they also believed, they kept looking for the day, and this is getting really close to the gospel. They're looking for the day when God will come to us. The doctor will arrive with us. The doctor will heal us. And that's the gospel. That's what Matthew is telling us. That's the story he's telling. That in Jesus, the doctor has come. The doctor has arrived with us. The doctor is healing us. The doctor is bringing mercy to everyone. He's bringing healing, not just to the people we think deserve it, but to the people who are totally inappropriate. But he's bringing healing to them, too. He's beginning to heal everyone who wants healing. And we're wrapping up as we're going to hit a flurry of slides right here. I think that brings us really close to something very central in Matthew's gospel. Something really, really important that if you think about Matthew's gospel, this is central. This is the flavor, a primary flavor in Matthew's gospel. Slide 7. If we want to really experience God's healing, we've got to give what we've been given. If we want to experience God's healing, we've got to give what we're given. The gospel is that God is arriving as the doctor. He's always already giving us mercy. You don't have to like pray for it. You don't have to ask for it. You don't have to beg and grovel for it. We're just invited to begin to believe it. God is merciful. He gives mercy. But if we want to really experience God's mercy, if we want to really experience the healing of God, we got to give this mercy to other people. Maybe, next slide, maybe we could say it this way. What we believe about God tends to look like how we behave towards others. What we really believe, what I really believe about God, it tends to look like how we behave towards other people. If you want to know what you believe about God, look at the way that you treat those around you. Look at the way, if I sent out a survey and asked you, if I asked other people, how does Joy treat you? How does Jen treat you? How does Eric treat you? What would they say? How do you behave towards other people? Would they say, well, she holds a grudge. She holds a grudge. He just can't seem to let things go. He doesn't trust other people. She seems to find fault in every little thing. If I were to guess, if I were to make a guess, when we find fault in every little thing, I think it's because something really deep within us believes that that's what God is like. That we believe that's the way the universe is. That's the way the world is. When we can't let things go, when we hold a grudge against someone, somewhere deep within us, I'm suspicious that we think that God is holding a grudge. We think that that's what the world's really like. Our behavior tends to look like what we actually believe. And then eventually our behavior ends up reinforcing what we already believe. We hold a grudge. We refuse to speak to that person. And then it makes us even more confident that that's the way that life should work. That's the way God is, probably. And throughout the Gospel of Matthew, you find Matthew warning people again and again and again. What we believe about God tends to look, what you really actually believe about God, if you want to find it out, take a look at how you're behaving towards other people. Next slide. David says something very similar in one of the Psalms. In Psalm 18, he sings, "With the merciful, you show yourself merciful. With the blameless, you show yourself blameless. With the purified, you show yourself pure. And with the crooked, you make yourself seem torturous." Notice what David isn't saying. David isn't saying that we actually change what God is like, what the universe is like, what the beating heart at the center of the universe is like. No, that would be crazy. We never change what God is like. Next slide. We never change what God is like. God is love itself. God is mercy and justice and goodness itself. God never changes. But our experience of God, our perception of God does change. Our experience of God does change. And it is intimately bound up, connected, Matthew says again and again and again, with the way that we behave, the way that we treat other people. That's why Jesus, again and again, is saying, "Mercy, mercy, mercy, grant mercy to other people, love other people, be merciful, forgive other people," because Jesus wants us to experience those things from God. He wants us to be able to believe those things about God ourselves, but to experience them, we've got to give them. We've got to give them. Next slide. I think that we most easily believe what we're most determined to give. I think that in your life, throughout your week, you most easily believe what you're most determined to give. If we are determined, if through the week you're determined that you're going to be suspicious of other people's motives, why did they do that? What's going on? There had to be something behind that. If you are determined to be angry and resentful, maybe not of everybody, but of that person, that person at least. If we are determined to not forgive other people, maybe just that person, maybe that group of people, because it was just too wrong, that is going to become our entire existence. That's going to become your entire existence. That's what we're going to experience ourselves. That's what we're going to most easily believe. You're suspicious and angry and resentful of other people, and you're going to end up believing that within yourself. That's the way you're going to view all of life. We're going to believe that eventually about God too. You're going to believe that about God too. But if we are determined to give love to those around us, if we are determined to be patient with that person, if we are determined that we are going to be compassionate, even when I don't want to be, with that person, that is going to become our existence. That's going to become the way that we view other people. That's going to be the way that we understand other people's motives. That's going to be, we're going to start seeing even the truth of reality, the truth, the heart of the universe, because that's what God is like. We're going to begin believing the truth about God. Next slide. To sum it up, I think we begin to believe God's mercy when we learn to give God's mercy. That's when we actually begin to believe the gospel's true. believe that God could love me, believe that God could be merciful towards me, is when we start giving it to other people. In Matthew's gospel, again and again, we'll see Jesus' strongest warnings are towards people like the Pharisees who see Jesus dining with the wrong groups of people, and they are refusing to give mercy. They refuse to give love. It's not that I get that forgiving people is hard, but it's I'm refusing to even take a step towards that. I refuse because those people, of all people, those people don't deserve it. Jesus gives the strongest warnings in Matthew to those kinds of people. That is going to become your entire existence. It's called hell. It's called hell. The outer darkness, weeping and gnashing of teeth. But Matthew has skin in the game on this one, because Jesus befriended him, invited him, dined with him when no one else would. Matthew has seen the gospel. Jesus has shown him mercy when everyone else showed him malice. That's what Jesus does for all of us. He shows us mercy. He gives mercy without measure. That's what God is like. And so Matthew has become an evangelist for the pardon of God. He's become an evangelist for the pardon of God. I'm going to announce it. You need to believe it and become it so that you can believe it more. Matthew has experienced the mercy of God in Jesus. And he's begun to realize that mercy can only heal us only when it starts getting into our blood. Mercy heals us when it starts getting into our blood. Again and again and again, Matthew wants to make sure that we hear Jesus telling us, be oh so careful the way you behave towards other people. Be generous to others. Forgive others. Show mercy to other people, because that's going to become your existence. How you behave towards others really is about what you believe about God. Or, as Jesus said it in the Beatitudes at the Sermon on the Mount, this would be a shorter sermon. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. So, may we give what we've already been given. May we experience, taste, fully enter into the mercy of God, because we are determined to give the mercy of God. And may we, like Jesus, walk the world as the pardon of God.